Well, carpet recycling evidently has taken it on the chin during the pandemic. However, results in the fourth quarter seem to be encouraging, and we're going to talk about that. We have with us Dr. Bob Peoples. He's Executive Director of CARE, the Carpet America Recovery Effort. And how are you, Bob? Glad to see you're healthy and well.
Well, good morning, Dave, and it's always good to be with you. And yeah, things are well in Nashville, Tennessee.
That's good. Well, you are the moving aroundest guy that I know.
Well, I haven't been on an airplane since February of last year, so it's quite different.
Yeah. Anyway, it's good to see that you are settled and enjoying. I assume you're enjoying Nashville.
Enjoying Nashville, and have got two young grandchildren that are just a constant source of energy and joy.
Certainly worth the trip. Well, now, we had talked sometime during the pandemic, and obviously carpet recycling has taken it on the chin. What's happening now? I guess we're at the latter end of the pandemic. Would that be a correct way of saying it?
Well, I hope we're at the latter end of the pandemic. I think, you know, I kind of believe in chaos theory, and sometimes nature throws us a curveball. So I think it remains to be seen how much longer we're going to be struggling with the impact of this pandemic. And I hope we learn a lot from it, because I don't think this is the last time we'll see this type of an event. So, but I would tell you that things have evolved quite considerably on the carpet recycling side, and I'm afraid the answer is really a twofold answer. California is rebounding very nicely right now. The rest of the U.S. is struggling. There's so many factors at play here, not the least of which is a great abundance of post-industrial material to compete with post-consumer materials that our recyclers produce. The demand for product out of California is very strong, but of course that's driven by some subsidies, which were really enhanced starting in March of 2020 due to the impact of COVID. We moved very quickly and very aggressively to support the recyclers to avoid loss of capacity, especially in the state. That strategy was very effective, as our carpet-based our California-based recyclers will tell you. On the flip side, the loss of the BPS program at the end of June of last year was traumatic for the national program outside of California. So to put it in perspective, it's important to keep in mind also that mills, both large and small, had the same impacts on cash flow as other people did. And there were more than 10,000 people lost their jobs or were furloughed in the carpet industry as well. So it's been tough across the board. I'd say this pandemic has had a global impact, which is changing society on many levels. And I think we'll see the implications of that play out over a number of years. And as we said a minute ago, I don't think we're completely out of the woods yet.
Okay. Now, from your report, I saw that the recycling rate hit 23%, which I think was a new high. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's true, Dave. In the fourth quarter of 2020, we hit 23% as an all-time record recycling rate in California. I actually believe we would have hit this level for the full year if it had not been for the pandemic. But I think it's more important to point out that that over the last 5 years, our recycling rate in California has increased 20% per year on average every year. Even in 2020, we saw a 10% increase despite the pandemic. And overall for 2020 in California, we hit 21% recycling, which is another record for us. But just as exciting as the recycling rate, and maybe even more important, is what we call the yield, or the rate at which we convert what gets collected into recycled output. When this program started, you know, 10 years ago, we were running 40% or so, maybe a little higher, which means for every 100 pounds you collected, 60 pounds were going to the landfill. Today, we're over 70%. And these impressive gains, when you consider we started with a blank sheet of paper in 2011, coming off a financial recession and now dealing with the pandemic. And it's all as a result of the hard work of the recyclers finding creative ways to use and recycle these materials.
I bet it's been tough sledding for these recyclers. Do most recyclers deal in products other than carpet? I guess they have to, don't they?
Well, the carpet recyclers are a bit unique. You got to recognize that this is rather unique recycle stream, and it requires specialized equipment, and each recycler is different. So there's no two that are the same in terms of the technology they practice, the quality of the products that they produce, and the markets that they serve. So the one thing that does go with carpet recycling is polyurethane pad recycling. You know, if you collect a square yard of carpet from a home, you're probably going to get a square yard of rebond foam from underneath it. And the good news is that the foam markets are strong and have been fairly stable. You know, a recycler today can count on anywhere from 15 to 19 or 20 cents a pound for the rebond foam. And that helps offset the cost on the carpet recycle side. So on an integrated economic basis, you know, the recyclers can make money.
So the number of recyclers out there that deal in post-consumer carpet, I have to imagine that during the pandemic, that shrunk.
I will tell you, we've lost probably as much as 75% of our collections nationwide. And I think until the economics do improve and the demand for consumer materials increases, post-consumer materials increases, I don't see a lot of new players stepping in. But that said, the commitment to depolymerization, or what we call depoly, is strong and growing. And I think a number of polymers will eventually reach the scale where when these plants come online, there'll be a demand for hundreds of millions of pounds of post-consumer polymers, in particular PET and polypropylene. And I think it's also important to remember that there is a nylon 6 depolymerization technology platform that operates globally right now as well. So you got three of the key polymers in the carpet world that either are or will be in high demand, hopefully in the next several years.
Now, the fact that several recyclers had to leave the business, in terms of volume going through the system, how has that affected that? I mean, have the others been able to pick that up and it's been relatively healthy for them?
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at California, there is some consistency there. Across the rest of the nation, there's an old expression that, you know, when you go through tough times, you weed out those that are not as strong or competitive, and that leaves a better opportunity for those that do survive. So, yes, there has been a certain element of that that's taking place here. But I think that the world of carpet recycling outside of California right now is very, very challenging, and part of that's a result of PET that's grown so much in the market. And we can talk about that in just a second. But I also wanted to share another thought with you, Dave. And I find it very frustrating and dealing with people that have unrealistic expectations. And these are people that have never run a business, have no experience planning and executing major engineering projects. They don't know anything about what it takes to do product development, testing, market penetration, or understanding supply chain logistics. So over 20 years, the CARE has been operational. We have a lot of experience in case studies to support these types of understandings. And I think sometimes these people, while they may have good intentions, they make recommendations or they pass laws that are not well thought through, and they don't understand the resulting consequences of their actions. I think one of these days, it would make a great series of academic business case studies, you know, if we were to go look at the experience over the last 20 years here.
Well, that's interesting. And I guess that's not going to change anytime soon, is it?
No, unfortunately, it's probably not. But my goal is to share facts and information and data with folks to try to enable good decisions as we go forward. And I think we've made a lot of progress, you know, in California on that front. We've shared a lot of the work that goes on behind the scenes in a great bit of detail with the Cal Recycle Agency that oversees our operations in California. And I think they've grown to appreciate that this is far more complex than the average person really appreciates.
Yeah. You didn't realize how much you were going to have to be an educator when you accepted this job, did you?
Well, you know, I love being on a college campus and talking with students. So maybe this is just an extension.
Yeah. Well, you're a natural for it. I've got a sideline here. I noted in getting ready for this interview that the rate of recycling for aluminum cans in 2019 fell. It fell to about 66% from 64% the previous year. Is recycling falling out of favor? Is that something that, well, that's not the pandemic, it's before the pandemic. Why is that?
Well, I think, Dave, you know, things run in cycles, and I don't think it's out of favor. Quite the contrary. I think you're going to see a greater emphasis, you know, in the future. We've taken a setback in this area as a result of the pandemic. But if you look at the commitments made by the large corporations, there's been very little backpedaling on this. And, you know, a number of companies have made major announcements and capital is being sunk in the ground as we speak right now. So, you know, there's enormous pressure on the global market around plastic waste, especially in the packaging sector. And I think it's going to change the way we look at plastics in the future. Plastics are important to achieving, you know, low environmental impacts. What we have to do is figure out how to close the loop on plastics. So you'll see these impacts coming online in the future as winners in dealing with closed loop technology. We do have to solve the leakage issue. That is plastics getting out of the cycle and into the environment. And I think we'll make progress on that front as well.
Does it scare you when you hear some of the things that are happening in Washington, sort of the anti-petroleum group? Does that make you have goosebumps?
Well, I think, Dave, that petroleum and natural gas, and probably to a small extent coal, is going to be with us for a long time. You don't make transitions from these types of basic technology infrastructure platforms in the short term. It takes long-term vision and commitment to do that. You know, you're not going to go out and buy a new car today and in 6 months decide you're going to sell it and buy another new car unless you're a billionaire and the money doesn't mean anything to you. So these companies have billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, of sunk investments in the ground. So we have to find a flight path that gets us through a transition that makes sense from a society point of view, from an environmental point of view, and recognize that it can't happen overnight. I think that, you know, I have a philosophy based on my years of working in Washington, D.C., running the Green Chemistry Institute, and that is industry, big companies are the ones that practice the technology that impact the environment in which we live, personally, professionally, business-wise. And when you attack those companies, you put them on the defensive, they stop listening, they start spending their time, money, and energy to fight the naysayers. What we need to do is find collaborative bridges to the future and get everybody reading from the same page and commitments that are realistic in terms of time frames. And oh, by the way, there's a subtle but important legal dimension here. And that is, if you've got somebody that you think produces a chemical that creates a human health or environmental problem, and they agree to change it, you've got to give them protection so somebody, some aggressive attorney or group doesn't come in and sue them for past practices. People do what they believe is best at the time they make those decisions, and retroactively trying to penalize them for that when they've made a public commitment to move in another direction is the wrong way to go. It puts industry back in the defensive mode, and that's not a win-win.
Do you ever consider going back to Washington? I think they could use you back there.
Well, Dave, I do believe that we would be better served if we could have some more technically trained people, you know, whether it's scientists, engineers, medical professionals, scientists in general, making some of these decisions based on, you know, scientific fact and solid science, as opposed to, you know, a lot of the political decisions that get made sometimes for expediency.
Hear, hear. Let's talk about carpet recycling. Now, obviously, recycling, I suspect, runs parallel to floor covering sales. What are the other things that affect the rate of recycling or the collecting and recycling post-consumer carpet?
Well, I think that, we typically say if you don't sell new carpet, you're not going to be ripping out old carpet. That's still true to the best extent, but we do know with the rise of LVT, there's a process called deselection. Deselection basically means I'm going to put in a new flooring, a hard surface flooring like LVT, and in the process, I'm going to be ripping out some carpet. So you have all the carpet replacement takes place, and on top of that, you have some deselection that occurs. We believe now we've got anecdotal evidence that says that peak deselection has already taken place, and people are starting to see some of the problems associated with hard surfaces. For example, you know, carpet is warm, especially in the northern climates or during the winter. Carpet provides softness underfoot, which has some value when it comes to kids playing, young children playing, or senior citizens that may trip and fall in a home. And it, of course, has a feature that most people don't think about, and that's acoustics. Acoustics are really important in the areas where we live and in the areas where we work. And a lot of people talk about taking the carpet out and putting in a hard surface. And I ask them, what's the first thing you do when you do that? Well, they go out and buy area rugs. And why do they do that? Well, because they want sound absorption, and they want a color block in the room, and they want softness underfoot and comfort. So I think you're going to see that the pendulum has swung a little too far on the hard surface side, and is probably going to start swinging back.
Interesting. Now, I know there's a couple of programs about to promote carpet recycling. I understand CARE has a number of those initiatives. So talk about that.
Well, yeah, we've probably been promoting carpet and the development of carpet technology and products for the 20 years that CARE has been in existence. You know, we've done grants. We still do grants. We've done technical assistance. We've provided financial support for development and testing materials. And I will say we provide consulting. So we try to assist people, whether it's, you know, using our expertise on what works and what doesn't work around equipment collection, materials, science and engineering, but also probably about a, you know, maybe close to 8 or 9 years ago, we started a tracking matrix where we scour the globe looking for technologies, equipment, products, and markets for our materials. That list has now grown to about 100 entries. We review them and update them quarterly, and that's been a good source of information for tracking down possibilities as well. You know, a good example is we funded 3 years of a doctoral student at NC State's Nonwovens Institute for the purposes of looking at outlets for PET carpet fiber post-consumer in the nonwoven sector. That's 3 years of work. We've gotten some finally good results out of that. And now the next stage for us is to open a dialogue with some major nonwoven producers to see if we can interest them in the technology that's been developed.
Interesting. Do you think there's a lot of people in the United States that would be amenable to recycle their post-consumer carpet, but there's no local facility where, you know, where they can do that?
I think in general, people want to do the right thing, but I also think it has to be extremely easy for them. And so I think it takes time to build out that kind of infrastructure. And when CARE started, we had the classic chicken versus egg situation to deal with. Do we develop the markets and let that justify creation of the infrastructure, or do we create the infrastructure and then try to move it into the markets? And it turned out that it was the latter that was the way to go. You know, if you go to somebody and say to them, you know, would you be willing to buy X number of pounds at this price, at this quality for this period of time? And they'd say, well, if you can guarantee me you can do those things, then we'll talk. So we quickly retrenched on our strategy and said we have to build the collection and processing infrastructure before we can really talk to people about moving the material. And, you know, we've had a major economic recession and now a major pandemic in the process of doing this. And we started with a blank sheet of paper. So I still look at this as a nascent industry, sort of still be in the process of being born. You know, you may recall that our 2020 conference, the theme was going to be carpet recycling comes of age, because I thought that all the groundwork had been laid. And of course, March of 2020 dealt us a door slammed in our face and the conference was canceled. So we've had to retrench and back up a little bit. But, you know, my motto since the beginning of CARE is success is perseverance for one more minute. And I think that, you know, we've been tested many times, but we continue to persevere and push forward trying to find answers.
Well, it's been interesting. You basically invented an industry. You know, there was nothing there before you started a blank piece of paper.
Right, right. It's been an exciting journey. And like I said earlier, I think it'll be an interesting academic set of case studies at some point in time if I get somebody interested enough to take it on. Maybe there's a real reality TV show, The Real Recyclers of the USA.
I like it. I tell you what, it's less crazy than a lot of the ones out there. So.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. The fiber type of the post-consumer carpet that's being collected, talk about that and how that's changing.
Yeah, there's been some pretty dramatic shifts. I'm sure that if you go back 20 years ago, it was all nylon 6 and nylon 6/6. And nylon 6/6 had a pretty good chunk of that market. 10 years ago, PET had grown to almost 30% and at the expense of the nylons. And today, PET represents 50% or more, depending on what segment you're talking about, of the fiber that's sold. Nylon 6 sits about 35%. Nylon 6/6 has shrunk to maybe 10% of the market, and that's virtually all commercial. And polypropylene is now around 5% from a high of 25%, you know, maybe during the days of Berber fashion trend. Nylons are still the champ in the commercial sector, but, you know, polyester has really grown into its own. And there's been a lot of technology evolution over the time period that's made those products more competitive.
And I guess there's an awful lot of use for post-consumer polyester carpet now, where I can remember a couple of years ago, it seemed like there was little or nothing.
Yeah, we've invested quite a bit in trying to develop the markets for this. Of course, most of the polyester movement is being driven out of California right now because we had to put some very high subsidies on PET to get it to move in the marketplace. At the end of the day, it all comes down to the economics. And so we've learned a lot of very important but also very painful lessons in the California experiment that's still playing out right now. The good news is we've developed some pretty sophisticated economic models. We're in the throes of a deep economic analysis on carpet recycling right now. And we think, at least on the California side, we got the subsidies in the right zone to have an impact. But I'm just going to share with you how crazy these subsidies are. Your listeners are aware that virgin calcium carbonate, which goes into the latex backing, is about a penny or two a pound delivered to the factory door. To get people to use recovered calcium carbonate from carpet processing, we have to pay 17 cents a pound out in California before that stuff would start to move. That's a pretty steep price to pay to find a way to reuse a material that has no value in the marketplace. But that move is what's contributed to increasing our yields up above 70%. Instead of throwing away half the weight of the carpet, we're now using the vast majority of that.
What or how has the situation in California, you've been there for a number of years, how is that affecting carpet recycling in the rest of the country?
Well, I think if you talk to the recyclers around the rest of the country, they'll tell you that the subsidies that are placed on materials coming out of California have hurt their efforts. You know, if somebody can get material in their door at zero cost or even put pennies in their pocket because of subsidies, they're not going to turn around and pay somebody, you know, outside of that subsidy platform for their material. But I do think it's important to remind listeners that, you know, we have a recycler in the Northeast, Sean Regal from Carpet Cycle, that has a great line that I've used for years. If you show me where I can get a free truck, a free driver, free insurance, and free gas and free rent, I'll do it for free. It costs money to do these things. Even the analytical tools that we use to identify the face fiber, which is important for most of the market outlets, these tools are $18,000 a piece and rely on sophisticated spectrographic technology. So, and you got to have at least two or three of them in case one breaks down or the battery goes dead in the middle of your operation. So, you know, those units and the equipment required to handle and process carpet is a major capital investment for recyclers.
Yeah. Well, it's not cheap to get in the business. Talk about these collectors and processors. I mean, I guess the total number you had mentioned earlier, the total number of these organizations has decreased during the pandemic. What's the health of the rest of them, and what's the prospect of somebody new coming into the business and when?
Yeah, I don't think you'll see anybody new coming in anytime soon until the demand for the materials outside of California continues to grow. And that's where, you know, these large chemical operations, which will demand hundreds of millions of pounds of feedstock for these continuous depolymerization reactors come into play. At that point in time, once those financial investments are made, they'll need to assure feedstock for those plants. And excuse me, Dave, we have some of that. We have some of that taking place today. Of course, you may be aware of Eastman Chemical out of Kingsport, Tennessee, has a process called carbon renewal. We have carpet that's going into that process today to produce plastic building blocks. So you're talking about closing the loop on these PET feedstocks. Eastman also has depolymerization technology, which they've committed to invest in. And in the next couple of years, we'll see demand for that going into a chemical depolymerization reaction on the scale of hundreds of millions of pounds of feedstock going in. So they'll need to secure those feedstocks. Procter & Gamble has their PureCycle technology for polypropylene. That's been demonstrated through a large pilot plant operation and a commitment made to build a plant, so there'd be demand for polypropylene. We mentioned earlier Nylon 6. Aquafil operates their depolymerization technology over in Slovenia today. They're taking Nylon 6 from around the world, you know, a U.S. carpet, textiles, and fishing nets that they pull out of the ocean and depolymerize that back to virgin quality Nylon 6, remake the polymer, and off they go with closing the loop. So I have strong hopes that, you know, we'll continue to see those expansions progress, and that demand for post-consumer carpet materials will continue to grow. That will be the key to successfully advancing carpet recycling.
Well, it sounds like you got a lot of major players that are interested in this and, you know, have activities going in this. That's got to be a very favorable sign.
Yeah, there's no question here, David. I come out of a, you know, a corporate background, $9 billion company that I worked in for years. And I will tell you that the contrast with the carpet recycle world today, which is a very small, highly competitive, but low margin business. I mean, I've watched one deal in my years change on a quarter of a cent a pound, a couple change on a half a cent a pound, and often they change on a penny or pound difference between the suppliers and the buyers. And a comment today to supply material is it could evaporate tomorrow or next week. So what I see the big players bringing to the game is a level of supply chain sophistication and commitment to long-term volume contracts that'll bring stability and justification for economic investments in the recycling infrastructure.
This is really where the rubber meets the road. Right. We were talking about education a little bit earlier, and it's one thing to, hey, you know, we really should do this. It's the right thing to do. But then making it work at the bottom line is something totally different.
Yeah, there's a number of nuances here. And, you know, we talked a little earlier, but there's so many factors that impact our integrated society today. So people don't connect the idea that the chip shortage that everyone's hearing about right now in the auto sector has a ripple effect right through the supply chain and is impacting our post-consumer carpet nylon suppliers. Because when the automakers shut down plants, they shut down demand from the tier one suppliers, and the tier one suppliers tell their suppliers, stop shipping, which is our carpet recycling folks. So that's just one example of a multitude of impacts that take place on the supply chains these days.
I hear you. Let me ask you about the CARES grant program. Talk a little bit about that, the criteria for somebody winning a grant, some of the recent grant winners, and the types of people that seek grants. And I guess also, I mean, this is a 8-part question, I guess, but what is CARE looking for in terms of grant seekers?
Well, let me take the second part first, Dave. I mean, we're looking for people that have an established track record that look like they can either collect or process or produce products on a significant scale. So if I got two grantees and one says, I want $500,000 and I think I can collect and process 1 million pounds a year, and it's going to take me 3 years to do that. And I get somebody that comes in and says, I can move 10 million pounds a year. I want $500,000 and I can get going in the next 18 months. I mean, that one's kind of a no-brainer. We don't have unlimited resources. So, you know, the second option is going to be more valuable to us than the first option. We do have a rigorous set of criteria. We use an independent review board that brings in different types of expertise, technical expertise, logistical expertise, business management expertise. And we've been fortunate to have some people in that group that has some background in carpet recycling, which tends to be a little bit unique. We do give grants in, and these grants are all driven out of California because of the funds we have there, but we give grants for capital investments. So obviously putting in new processing capacity, shredders, balers, extruders, whatever. We give grants for technical product development and testing. We give what are called micro grants, which are grants to smaller grants given to municipalities and collectors and sorters to buy equipment to enable them to start ramping up collection. So it could be to buy a container, could be to put down a concrete pad on which to set a container, buy a set of stairs or a cover, you know, build a small cover to protect the contents of the container from getting wet in a rainstorm. So those are the kinds of things we do. And we do periodically review the performance of those grantees. Those set cycles require regular reporting requirements to make sure they're meeting their commitments. And I'd say right now, on average, we're running about, people are hitting about 50% of their commitments in terms of their volumes and their timing. We've run into a few examples that are outside of anyone's control. For example, one city in California took well over a year to issue permits on a project that had been given a grant, which we had expected to start up. It took over a year for startup. A second company built a plant in California. They needed power delivered to that plant. The power was delivered more than 18 months behind the promised schedule, which means and that plant got a grant from CARE. That plant sat there idle for over 18 months before they could even get started. And that plant is just starting up as we speak. So we're really excited to see the output start to flow in the second quarter of this year.
Interesting. Talk about some of the products that are made from post-consumer carpet.
Yeah, so I think the first thing I'd tell you is that there is a product catalog on the CARE website that you could download as a PDF, and it has a listing of all the products, but it also gives you contact information for the company. So if you're interested, you can go out and buy those products. But we have obviously under the hood of a car, there's a lot of black plastic injection molded parts. There's a large amount of post-consumer nylons that go into those parts. So those are some of the products that are made. We have exterior lumber products like dimensional lumber, like trim lumber that are being made out of post-consumer carpet. We have an interesting product called a decorative aggregate, which is an innovative approach to recycled materials. We take, or the company takes, post-consumer paints that have been collected, mixes them with post-consumer carpet backing material and cement, creates a product that they add a colorant to and grind up, and you have a decorative cement aggregate that you could put down around your home or in your flower beds or anything of that sort. We have fiber pad underlay for carpets, which go primarily into the commercial sector. We've got post-consumer carpet going into insulation, wall insulation for sound acoustical properties and obviously thermal properties. So we do have a variety of products that this is going into, and our goal is to continue to expand those because there's no reason to collect and process carpet if you don't have products to put it into and markets to buy those products. And maybe the last point I'd like to make here, Dave, is that I think states, local municipalities, even the federal government could assist because these entities spend tens of billions of dollars a year on public procurement. And if they would just say that some of those products that we buy should be made with post-consumer content in them, that would help create the demand pull through that justifies the investment in these technologies to get the recycling going.
Is that happening anywhere?
Not really. There's been a lot of talk about it. California even has a law in the book called SABRAC, State Agencies Buy Recycled Content, which is the right concept. but very little is actually happening along those lines. And we are talking to folks about how can we, you know, reinvigorate the post-consumer content side, especially for things like carpet.
I see. Last question. Talk about your expectations for post-consumer carpet going forward. And what would you say needs to take place to make this thing move along a little bit quicker?
Well, I still am very positive on the potential future for carpet recycling, especially driven by the comments earlier about large corporations starting to sink hundreds of millions of dollars of capital in the ground, which will demand feedstocks. We got to get the economics right for the recyclers, and that's going to take us a little bit more time until that demand comes online. We do compete with other sources of feedstocks for those plants. So we got to make sure that there are mechanisms in place to make the post-consumer carpet competitive. There's also a lot going on at the national level. I think you may have referred to that a little bit earlier. There's some discussion about investments in new legislation to fund the development of recycled technology. There's a major multi-agency initiative called REMADE, which is investing in, you know, recycled materials. CARES made a few forays working with academic partners into securing funding. We have not had success with REMADE at this point in time, but whether it's REMADE or some other national legislation that provides funds available to us to help facilitate both the ongoing development work and the investment in the technology platforms, I think those are the things that give me confidence that we're going to make progress going forward.
I can see you're a very busy guy.
Yeah, there's no lack of opportunity.
I hear you. Bob, I really appreciate you spending some time with us and giving us this education. You are indeed an educator. And thanks very much for spending some time with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Dave. I always enjoy talking with you, and hopefully your listeners can help us make a difference.
I hope so. We've been talking with Dr. Bob Peoples, Executive Director of CARE, the Carpet America Recovery Effort, and this is Talk Floor TV.